One, hold the paper up. One, two, three.
You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, December 2nd, 2013. My name is Matt Binder.
I am Michael Brooks.
And this is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting to you live in the literal but not metaphorical shadow of the New York Times building.
In the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City, Matt and Mike Monday. On today's program, Jeff Mulgan, author of The Locust and the Bee, Predators and Creators in Capitalism's Future. We're going to be talking about the future of capitalism, whether it can be a positive or negative force, how to redesign it, and a lot more.
We will also be discussing the Black Friday Walmart protests. Walmart workers took to the streets. Well, took to the Walmart parking lots, I guess you could say. I almost got a little Boston there for a second.
Yeah,
the Walmart
parking lots. That was interesting.
Yeah, but...
That was huge.
That was huge, yeah. No, but... Well, first of all, I hope you all had a good holiday break. If you had a break. Hopefully none of you had to work on Thanksgiving or
seriously.
On Black Friday. Seriously. Because it... From what I saw, got a little bit dangerous out there.
Yeah, terrible. Looked like there was some... I saw a video of, like, the best fights at Walmarts across Thanksgiving, which is really tasteless.
You're part of the problem.
Oh, I'm totally part of the
problem. You're part of the
problem. I couldn't believe that video got posted, but I did watch it. I'm also going to be talking with you about the myths that the neocons and neocon-esque type people floating around Washington are pushing to sink this Iran breakthrough that we've been celebrating the last week. New research on the minimum wage and why it's below the poverty level and what we can do to raise it and how we need to raise it, including some advocacy from the Financial Times. And Pat Robertson,
oh boy,
has come forward with some pretty amazing advice that has actually gotten our attention. And we're actually fairly studious about not jumping every time Pat Robertson says something insane, because we would just be jumping all the time. But this one was a little too good to miss.
What else do we got today? We've got, along with that Pat Robertson clip, we have another clip today from a Fox News host who thinks, unlike blank, it touches so many people's lives. Blank touches so many people's lives. You'll be able to fill in those blanks when we get to the story later in the program.
Yeah, and also we should just note, yesterday there was a terrible tragedy here in New York City. There was a train that derailed the Metro North Line. I think 4 people have died so far, have been reported. There was obviously a lot of injuries. I've definitely been on that Metro North Line. That hit pretty close to home. And we should also mention that there are massive demonstrations going on in the Ukraine about that country's decision, that government's decision to back out of some new laws, some basically to bring the UK in alignment with the European Union.
With Russia, and they chose.
And more, yeah, they went more with Russia, which is not great news for that, for the human rights standards and other things in the Ukraine. So I'm sure we'll talk about that more this week, because that's a huge protest. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with Jeff Mulgan, author of The Locust and the Bee and head of the Nesta Foundation, joining us from London in the UK. We'll be right back.
Yo, remember back on the bully when cats used to harmonize like, yo, yo, my men and my women, don't forget about the dean, this is not the most the king, yo, it's about a thing, yo,
feel real good, wave your hands in the air. never called you again. Remember when he told you he was about to Benjamin's? Yeah. You act like you ain't him, they give him a little trim to begin. Now you think you really gonna pretend like you wasn't down and you called him again. Plus when you give it up so easy, you ain't even fooling him. If you did it then, then you probably can. Talking out your neck saying you're a Christian, a Muslim, sleeping with the gin. Now that was the sin that did Jezebel in. Who you gonna tell when the repercussions spin? Showing off your ass cause you're thinking it's a trend, girlfriend. Let me break it down for you again. You know I only say it cause I'm truly genuine. Don't be a hard rock when you really are a gin, baby girl. Respect is just the minimum. But you still defending them now. Lauren is only human. Don't think I haven't been through the same predicament. Let it sit inside your head like a million women in Philly pen. It's silly when girls sell their souls because it's sin. Look at where you be in. Hair weaves like Europeans. Fake nails done by Koreans. Come again.
We are back on the Majority Report. My name is Matt Binder.
And I am Michael Brooks. And joining us now is Jeff Mulgan. He's the author of The Locust and the Bee, Predators and Creators in Capitalism's Future. And he is also, oh, Jeff, I'm just about to mess this up. He's the chief executive of the Nesta Foundation?
That's right, yeah.
Oh, well, all right, great. I didn't mess it up. So, you have a book, the book that I've just mentioned, The Locust and the Bee, where you have an argument, I think in some respects, in my view, about kind of different brands of capitalism or different ways of going about capitalism. And two are distilled really in the title of your book. What is locust capitalism and what's bee capitalism?
Well, first of all, what the book came from was an attempt to understand what was happening around the crisis 2008 onwards. So I've got a background which has been sometimes working in business and technology. Where I work now, we invest in companies and also back NGOs, and I've worked in governments around the world. And I was trying to make sense of what the origins of the crisis were, but more importantly, how we found our way out. And for me, part of the key came in trying to distinguish both the positive and the negative behaviors of capitalism, which I argue are inherent to how it's always been. And indeed, I went back to Adam Smith for these definitions. Adam Smith, who's often thought of as just a proponent of free markets, if you read his early writings, he was much more sophisticated than that. He showed that in any market, entrepreneurs, business people will have some incentives to produce useful things, to create genuine value. These are the bees in my language. But there's always also incentives to be predators, to exploit, to extract people, to create monopolies. And in some ways, you can see the history of capitalism has always been a bit of a tension between these tendencies to predatory exploitative behavior on the one hand, but also its enormous capacity to generate wealth, to create new ideas, new technologies. And I argue a lot of the reasons we had the crisis in the last decade was that the predatory side of capitalism became much stronger relative to its creative side. And in essence, what we need to do now is the opposite.
So what brings about the ascendancy of this predatory capitalism? I'm thinking of obviously the kind of origins of the crisis were driven out of a lot of the practices in the financial sector, Wall Street, at Citi, in London. Was the ascendancy of those practices, do you see that as simply a case of kind of rampant deregulation, or do you also see a kind of problematic and flawed ideology or intellectual system attached to propping a kind of predatory brand of capitalism you're talking about?
Well, this isn't the first time it's happened.
Sure.
In the most recent wave, it was finance, which became particularly predatory by the middle of the 2000s in the US. Finance was taking nearly half of all corporate profits. It was extracting value on a massive scale from the real economy. And it was doing so partly because it had rigged the rules of the game through lobbying and politics, as well as influencing, you know, the ideologies of how economies were run. In other periods, the predation has had its roots in other places, sometimes within the mainstream economy, when business sort of took advantage of its workers or of consumers. At other times, the most important predatory behaviors have been of the economy on the planet and on nature. And these are inherent dynamics. And I argue in the book, they always will, there will always be a tendency towards predatory behavior in any system, just as there will be in societies where people unfortunately tend to take advantage of others unless they're held back by rules, by social norms. And the history of civilization, in some ways, has been the history of how we've learned to stop predatory behaviors, whether it's by warlords or gangs, or for that matter, people, you know, exercising domestic violence in the home. And the economy is no different from that. There will always be tendencies to predation unless we're vigilant, unless we put in place the rules, the social norms, the cultures, which make it difficult.
Yeah, so this is kind of, you're talking very broadly and kind of holistically about how to respond to this. And I'm wondering, I think that this is a good launching point for you to kind of get into more of some of the distinctions you're talking about. I know on this program and in a lot of the public debate taking place in the United States and in Europe, which I think is an important debate, it's certainly the argument between stimulus or austerity. Certainly, this show has a very strong stimulative position and a strong critique of austerity. But it seems to me that some of the things you're pointing to, you probably have a view of that debate. But you're getting, you're trying to get to another place, because it's not just a question of sort of shrinking the deficit, slashing services, or just stimulating anything for the sake of stimulating and investing. It's a question of what we're stimulating, what we're investing in, and using this crisis as an opportunity.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there's two ways in which the debate post 2008 has gone wrong, or rather settled into very comfortable, familiar positions, which I don't think are very helpful. So one polarity is the one which is between people who say all markets are good, capitalism is always good, and people who say all markets and all capitalism is bad. That debate dominated much of the 20th century. It's in a way revived since the crisis, but it's not actually that helpful, because the real question, I argue, is what kinds of capitalism, what kinds of economy, what kind of market do you want to promote, and which kinds do you want to constrain? And the same applies to the stimulus, which in a way was the Keynesian debate of the 30s and 40s. And it's a very important practical argument in each country, though with slightly different conditions in each country. How much should you put cash, put spending power into the economy? But again, I think it's the wrong question long term. The right question is exactly as you put it, is what things do we want to grow and what things do we want to shrink? And that takes you to a much finer grained and more detailed discussions about how you regulate the finance, how you regulate banks, which sectors you want to grow and in what way, rather than just pouring money into often the old industries and often the industries which were failing before the crash. And the great risk of, I think, a sort of simplistic stimulus positions is they actually prop up precisely the parts of the system which were most in crisis even before the financial crash hit. So bailing out, you know, the core industries of the old economy, which often are the best connected, the most politically influential, rather than growing the sources of future prosperity.
Right. So this is interesting. And then would you say, actually briefly on this, would the kind of converse of that would be with austerity, that you're just not making funds available, because obviously government is a part of, if you're talking about a kind of broad multi-sector approach, you do need government investment and government participation in spurring some of the innovation you're talking about.
Absolutely. I mean, the U.S. has been an innovation superpower for 50 or 60 years, in large part because of massive public investment since the Second World War in computing, in aerospace, in a whole host of other industries. And there's no doubt in my mind that we need to take those sort of models a step further. The kind of investment in innovation you see in countries like Finland or Taiwan or Israel or Korea, which are now becoming the sort of dynamos of the 21st century economy. They're investing in R&D, they're investing in science, but they're also backing the new growth sectors. And I show in the book that if you look to the next 10, 20, 30 years, which sectors will grow most is not going to be ones like cars. Cars will remain important, but they'll almost certainly shrink as a share of GDP, whereas sectors like health, care for the elderly will grow. The creative economy, we've done a lot of work on analyzing it. It's growing about four times faster than the economy as a whole. The public sector is going to become increasingly important as a field of innovation itself. because otherwise it becomes a drag on society and a drag on the economy. So many of the frames of the past debate, which were all about things like cars and infrastructure and bailing out banks, in many ways were looking at our economy in a sort of static, backward-looking way, not thinking about what type of economy, what kind of jobs do we want a generation hence.
So this makes a lot of sense to me in a very broad sense, and I want to get into more specific details of where you see some of this really promising innovation happening across sectors. But going back to the auto bailout briefly, because I think maybe we have some genuinely different perspectives on it, but I think it also gets to the heart of what's difficult about making the transition to some of the more type of long-term thinking that we really need to do and what you're advocating for, which is that, and I think in some respects, you know, President Obama did attach some new environmental standards and some new efficiency standards with the auto bailout, but it certainly was the case that if that had not happened, the economic crisis, depression in the United States would have just would have been exponentially even worse than it already was. So, and I think that that's, and even with the banks, which maybe I'm more critical of that bailout, there was, as you know, I mean, there was really the potential of maybe you can't get money from your ATM for a period. You know, things were at this real crisis point, as you know. When governments and institutions generally are responding so quickly to these very real but very immediate crises, and maybe they don't feel the cognitive or organizational ability to even think in these longer terms, how do you strike that balance, I guess? How do you speak to that dynamic?
I think that's one of the biggest challenges for any government. I spend quite a lot of my time advising ministers and prime ministers on strategy. And always they have to deal with the world as it is. They have to deal with crises as they emerge. And what governments did in the few years after 2008 was in some ways an extraordinary assertion of the virtues of active government responding very fast on an extraordinary scale and in very flexible ways to the meltdown of the financial system. And so I don't knock Obama for the auto bailout. What I think is the sad thing about what's happened in the last 5 or 6 years is having been so phenomenally effective in the short-term responses to crisis, governments around the world have been much, much worse at using the crisis to lay the long-term foundations for a different kind of economy. So just taking cars as an example, all sorts of things happening around existing car industries, about the shift to self-driving cars, but also around the world, a proliferation of new car sharing platforms, the collaborative consumption economy, which says you don't actually need to buy a car. You can, you know, share your cars with your neighbors and rent as you need it. And that's a completely different way of thinking about the economy than the post-war economy, which is all about every individual, every family owning one, two or three cars, and then with SUVs getting them ever bigger. And I would look to political leadership to be, yeah, bailing out industries like the car industry if there's a viable package, but putting a lot of resource as well into nurturing the future versions of the car economy, which, as I say, will, I think, in large part be on one hand self-driving, automated, and on the other hand, much more collaborative and much more shared than I was brought up to expect.
Yeah, or even me, maybe as someone who's a bit younger, not too much younger, but maybe me as well. But that, so collaborative consumption, that's one example. That's really interesting. What are some other areas that when you talk about the innovation economy, more sustainable, more collaborative, whatever other words may be appropriate, what are other examples of this kind of concretely manifested that you would point to?
Well, in one of the chapters in the book, I look at the shift which you can see happening all over the world from an economy mainly focused around commodities, the sale of things, of stuff, like cars or, for that matter, iPads and so on, towards an economy where much more value lies in relationships. And it's an economy where often we're trying to maintain things to keep them good rather than just consuming things. Now, that may sound very abstract, but let me give you two or three examples. First of all, healthcare. Health is, I think, 17% of GDP in the US, so far and away the biggest sector. And it's the one everyone expects to become ever bigger over the next few decades. Now, you can think of the health economy as all about selling stuff, selling, you know, drugs or new devices. But in fact, most of that 17% is care, is people doing things for other people. And increasingly, it's going to be caring for people with long-term conditions like diabetes or cancers, which are not fatal but last for a long time. And whereas maintaining the body, maintaining the mind becomes a much more important part of health than just delivering commodities. You can see the same in relation to the green economy. Part of the green economy is about selling LED light bulbs and, you know, new stuff, which is more environmentally friendly. But a large part of it is about how we look after things, how we look after buildings, how we look after land, how we look after animals. And many of the jobs of the future green economy are much more that kind of guardianship, maintenance, helped by much smarter technologies to track emissions and analyze data, but in some ways more similar to almost a pre-industrial economy than the very commodity-driven, consumption-driven economy of the 20th century. And in all of those cases, relationships, the quality of relationships is key to value. And of course, this is already blindingly obvious in the social media. In Facebook, in Google, in Twitter, you know, a lot of the value being created around their IPOs and so on is essentially a guess that the value of understanding relationships, tracking them, measuring and so on them is more important than the value of just producing and selling commodities.
Absolutely. How does the, you know, all of this is happening in all of these areas, and I think, you know, examples of what you're talking about are just proliferating everywhere. I mean, I live in Brooklyn, and they kind of, it's kind of almost become a bit of a comedy and easy to make fun of at this point. But in other ways, it's great. The kind of proliferation of, you know, do-it-yourself culture and food and business and small startups and in art, you know, across a variety of platforms and businesses and artistic outlets. This is obviously very prevalent, very important, and is going to lead to a lot of good. And then on the other hand, we see this kind of spike, certainly in the United States. We're overwhelmed with the question of inequality, stagnant mobility, and just kind of serious gaps in kind of basic access. And then we haven't seen, as an example, social media, in terms of the kind of the tangible rewards of those platforms are going to very few hands and very few sectors. So how does that, the kind of inequality question, start to get addressed in this economy that we're talking about?
I think that's going to be the central question of the next few years. Because as you were implying, these new sort of green shoots of a new kind of economy in food or the arts or health, they're still relatively small. They're growing fast, but they're still not strong enough and at a sufficient scale to replace the dominant systems. And therefore, they're not generating enough opportunities for millions and millions of people in countries like the US or the UK. And that's why I think politicians have to both try and fix the present and lay the grounds for the future. For my money, though, what we need is as energetic innovation around equality and opportunity as we've had perhaps on these issues like health and education and food. So just to give two or three examples of things I'm involved in, which I hope are practical answers. Yeah. One is to change the school system. So we've been creating new networks of schools here in the UK and in other countries, which try to address what's turned out to be one of the key aspects of educational inequality in modern societies, which isn't just unequal access to good maths and good science and good English, but also to the cultural capital, the ability to work in teams, to be creative, to be entrepreneurial. And so, for example, in the network of studio schools, which I spent much of last week with, we're creating a new kind of school very much aimed at traditional working class industrial areas to try and help teenagers in those areas be much more prepared for the kind of jobs being created in the new sectors. We're looking at new ways of organizing capital. As you say, the capital rewards from this new economy have been incredibly narrowly distributed to a handful of really lucky investors in California and elsewhere. And so we need to move to much better ways of sharing ownership in the new economy, giving people of all kinds a stake in the new. And in sectors like health, which is health and care for the elderly, which are bound to expand in terms of numbers of jobs, we need a very different sort of mindset to help people, particularly men, get reasonable opportunities in those sectors, but also to regulate them so they provide reasonably secure jobs with reasonable prospects of pensions and training and so on, rather than the, here we call it the zero hours contract, the very insecure, utterly deregulated sectors, which perversely have the result that care for us in old age, which should be something which matters enormously to us, that we are cared for well, we treat as almost the least important job in our society. Whereas fiddling with finance, we pay enormous rewards to. We've got our values completely upside down.
Absolutely, and that's a very large area of labor organizing in the United States. In fact, is home care work and things like that. So there's definitely a parallel there. As we begin to wrap up this conversation, going back to the sort of philosophical orientation of your book and this whole conversation. I've been thinking a lot about Carl Polanyi recently, and the notion that he got at of saying that, you know, the problem was when society started working for markets and markets no longer worked for society, or something to that effect. That's certainly a simplification, but that's one of the kind of driving points he was getting after. Or another guy like E.F. Schumacher, who talked about scale, who talked about recognizing different values into an economy. In addition to all of the practical and actionable things you're talking about, it is a kind of philosophical or ideological shift of what we value and how we organize these frameworks. Is that as necessary for laying these groundworks as anything else?
I think it's always the case that getting to the right questions matters even more than getting to the right answers. And it's the frame with which our societies think about how to think about the economic crisis and the way out is for me the top priority now. And that's why just thinking of it in terms of pumping more liquidity or money or stimulus into an otherwise unchanged economy does not sound very satisfactory to me. And for me, the key is exactly as you say, how do we get back to thinking of the economy as a servant of the things we care about, the servant of our values, the servant of society? And if we can get a more sort of rigorous debate about the locusts and the bees, so that we watch out for those areas of economic activity, those behaviors which are predatory in nature, and we make it normal to try and constrain them and regulate them and prevent them, and that we're equally energetic in looking out for the bees, the creative people creating value, and we get the barriers out of their way, allow them to generate ideas and wealth. That's the route to a much better society. And it's very interesting here in the UK, just in the last 6 months, we've seen a big shift of public debate where both the major parties are now competing to tackle predatory behaviors in the economy, whether that's by energy companies charging overly high prices, payday loan companies exploiting vulnerable poorer people. In a way I've not seen for a generation, we've got both sides realizing that if they're not serious about stopping predation, they won't be credible for the public. What's still slightly missing, though, is equally energetic policies and ideas about how to generate creativity and innovation. Without that, we will obviously have a stagnant economy long into the future.
Absolutely. Jeff Mulgan is the author of The Locust and the Bee, Predators and Creators in Capitalism's Future. It's a very important, very interesting book that covers and obviously goes far beyond the conversation we've just had. Jeff, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you very much.
Take care. All right, folks. Very, very interesting conversation. Are you there?
I'm there. I just had to turn myself down during that interview because
what?
There was some noise outside. That
yes, yeah. That was. Oh, is that what happened? Because I was
sure
waiting.
To...
I was looking for you on the IM. Is that we had some? What was it, like sawing or something?
There's some sort of construction going on right outside, and I was doing everything possible to make sure you all didn't even know about it.
It was well done. One time I was doing a TV interview, and it was over satellite. So, you know, it's already like a kind of awkward thing, as you know, because you're sitting in this chair and you're staring at a camera and they say, like, just keep your eye, like, on the red light, basically. And, you know, it's an awkward thing, and you just work to make it as unawkward as possible. And it just so happened that on this one day underneath the TV studio, they were doing, like, they must have just been gutting the floor below, just like a complete renovation. So I have the earpiece in. She's asking me questions. I literally could barely hear her questions. And then at one point while I was answering, the floor below me started to shake. So that was pretty amazing. I think we have time for a couple stories I can get to.
You could get to a story before we go to the better half, I would say.
Oh, so, well, what do you think I should do in the first half?
Let's tease through some of these and
let's tease through some of these.
And then we'll pick one.
Okay. Well, new research on what the minimum wage would look like if it kept up pace with the 1%. And some new thoughts on why we need a minimum wage. Nothing new, but in terms of this audience, probably. But more ammunition for this really important argument. There's this new video. I don't know if you watch. If you watch our great YouTube channel, which, of course, you should be subscribing to.
YouTube.com/Sam Seder.
Yes. You will have seen an ad, I'm guessing. And not just on our channel. I'm guessing almost any political YouTube channel, you will have seen an ad called Iran Facts, which is an animated it's illustrated history. Incredible fear-mongering about Iran. I could talk about that. It was also sent in by a listener who wanted me to talk about it. And I'll talk about that and some other things that people are working to do to sink the Iran deal. That's one possibility. And then the final possibility is this just kind of magical piece of sound from Pat Robertson, along with that sound. And, you know, in keeping with the Iran story, it might be time for us to, you know, well, there might be a secret in the Majority Report office that would certainly frighten Pat Robertson.
Maybe we should go with the Pat Robertson sound.
Okay, let's go with the Pat Robertson sound. Okay. So Pat Robertson, as we know from covering this before on the 700 Club, sometimes takes with his co-host will read him emails they get of questions from his viewers, because, you know, and I think, to be fair, with, you know, people signing over their life savings to Pat Robertson and the amount of money he's been able to scrounge off of these people, the least he could do is give them great advice, like, what's your problem, with asking God to grow fingers back? He already healed your cancer. Shouldn't you be happy with that? Or your husband wouldn't cheat on you if you weren't ugly. Or, sometimes you need to smack your wife. Other great things. Or, you know, obviously things that I had no idea about. Now I know when I go to San Francisco, I'm very studious to not let a gay guy, slip AIDS into me through pricking my finger with a knife or something. You would never know these things if Pat Robertson did not have the generosity to take your emails. And he has gotten one such email from a woman that sounds like she was actually doing a really wonderful thing for a kid in her neighborhood who needed help. And let's take a listen.
Oh, Kimberly writes, a few years ago, a neighbor of mine came to our house. He said his father had kicked him out. I told him he could stay with us. He was very thankful and polite while he stayed with us, and I learned that he was a Muslim, and I heard him praying to Allah in my home. I was okay with it, but one day I felt an evil presence while cooking in my kitchen. I told my visitor that he needed to leave, go home, and resolve his own issues, but I feel horrible, like I violated Matthew 25:45-46. Did I do the right thing? I don't feel like I should only extend charity to other Christians.
I would like to say, Kimberly, that no, you did not do the right thing, regardless of whatever Pat Robertson's about to say to you.
And regardless of any line in the Bible. But go ahead.
No, you shouldn't extend charity only to Christians. You should extend charity to those that need it. But it doesn't mean you have to bring an unclean spirit into your home. And I don't know. I wasn't there. Don't understand the circumstances. But if somebody in truth is worshiping some sort of a demonic presence, then that will pervade your home. And no, you don't want to go for hospitality to something like that. Ooh.
Well, I mean, it's weird because as I'm... Matt, do you feel some type of demonic, some weird presence in the Majority Report offices?
Something's different.
Something feels really... I noticed the other day, I was wondering why Sam was looking at a Quran. Something's wrong here. Now I understand why we've been advocating the Iran deal and other terrible things about Muslims. They've infiltrated this office. Quick, please, turn it off, Matt. Oh my God.
There's total.
Pat Robertson was right. No, but let's break down this exchange in human sanity terms. So this woman did an incredibly generous and good thing for whatever motivation. If it was a Christian motivation, who knows? That's a wonderful thing to do. If your neighbor's kid comes to you and they're in trouble and they're a good kid and you help them out like that, that's beautiful. Now, clearly this woman has some psychological and emotional issues, because she does things like listen to Pat Robertson.
Yes.
Which is very bad for your mental health. If you listen to Pat Robertson like we listen to Pat Robertson, it's great for your mental health. You'll laugh so much, we'll add 10, 15 years to your life. But if you listen like Take Him Seriously, that is a really, really, really dangerous prospect for your mental well-being. So one day while she was in the kitchen, she heard this kid doing something totally innocuous, which was, perform his religious obligations. Incidentally, if you know any history, praying to the same theoretical God that she worships. And she had a paranoid outbreak because she listens to Pat Robertson.
She felt an evil presence. What is that even?
It was probably the hum of a fire alarm that needed to have a battery change.
Yeah.
That was probably literally what it was. Or maybe she forgot that she put something in the microwave and the timer went off. Or maybe she just feels anxiety and depression because she listens to Pat Robertson and it's not good for your mental health. So then she had this paranoid outbreak because she listens to this garbage. And then she emailed Pat Robertson. And Pat Robertson's like, yeah, you know, look, of course, charity's good. But hey, demonic presence, therefore adding to the loop of this lady's paranoia. And of course, lost in the mix is what this kid is going to do because he was kicked out of his father's house. So kudos, Pat Robertson. You never fail to deliver. And in that sense, I mean, be awful.
It really is unbelievable. Every time we have a Pat Robertson clip on this show, it just never ceases to amaze me. It just always, if it doesn't top it, it goes a completely different direction that is still just as incredibly unbelievable.
What I think is great about Pat Robertson now in his career is that he's in the grouchy old man stage along with everything.
Sam says it perfectly when he says how now it's just the ramblings of like whatever comes to his mind. He just lets it out on TV now.
Right.
It's like if you were to put a camera in any old white Christian man's home, this is what you'd see.
Right. And I mean, I like how he's, I mean, there's nothing more to add to it. I think that's exactly right. Are we going to go into the better half of the show now?
We're going to go into the better half
of
the show.
All right, folks, become a member. Become a member at Majority Report /member. That's a great way of keeping this. I mean, I think we all know this is a pretty indispensable show. All kidding aside, this is a really important show. And as Sam always says, less than a cup of coffee a day, certainly less than a cup of coffee, any type of fancy coffee, which some of our listeners may be listening to, maybe drinking. So please, please, please become a member. Follow us. Subscribe to us on YouTube. That is really, really fun. It's a great way of watching these videos. You get to also actually see Pat Robertson. As an example of that clip, not just hear him, you get to see his confused and grouchy face. He always looks like he's like chewing on a lemon and just saw a Muslim kid. So so subscribe to us on YouTube. Follow us on Twitter if you do that at Majority FM.
You can go to justcoffee.coop and get all your finest chocolates, coffee, from and support us. Fair trade and support the show.
Fair trade, majority
with coupon
trade.
Code majority. Also, according to Just Coffee, as of now, they are now delivering our coffee to Canada, in Canada. So for all you Canadian listeners out there, jump on that.
Jump on it. And what's the new address for buy everything if you're on Amazon? Buy it through Amazon.
Yeah, if you're going to do the Cyber Monday stuff today.
We have a specific
link definitely,
now.
Yes, it's majority. What is it? It's like majority kickback or something.
I think
like
it's majority kickback. Why don't you take a second to check that so everybody can know. We know that you guys are using Amazon. It doesn't cost you anything. It gives us a little kickback. What is it?
Majority Report Kickback.
MajorityReportKickback.com. That's what it is. MajorityReportKickback.com. Buy all of your items through our link to Amazon. We'll be right back in the better half of the show. If you want to call the show, 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. We'll be right back.
What was that number again, Michael? 646-257-3920. All right, we'll be back.
We'll be right back.
Satan, I will pay.